copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm going to start here with a question. And I'm not entirely sure how much this question applies to Europe, though I suspect it does as much as the States. But you'll have to decide. My question is, why is it that so many people seem to be angry at Christians? I mean, there's a lot of conflict in the States with regards to Christianity in the public square and Christian ideas held by genuine followers of Christ, not by Christendom writ large. Because there are a lot of churches that, in my opinion, just are not following Christ in the gospel and in other things that seem ethical issues that seem to be natural outworkings of a proper understanding of a biblical worldview. And they're not having trouble. They're not annoying other people. They've joined the other side for all practical purposes. But for those who are faithful followers of Christ, that is, they are saying the same kinds of things that Jesus said with regards to the world and people and theological realities. Well, those are the ones that are getting in trouble, and they're often seen in the States, at least, as a dangerous threat to liberty and freedom, which is a bit surprising since, you know, it's pretty much Christian types, the kind of people that would now be considered pejoratively as fundamentalist Christians that have pretty much run things for the last 250 years in the States and have produced largely freedom and prosperity. You know, so it's odd to think of what the problem is. But I think that the anger at Christians has to do with the power of an idea. And it's something that people are, as it turns out now, are deeply confused about, and that idea is called tolerance. And I want to give you a few examples of the confusion just from my own exposure, my own time traveling around and speaking in the States and in North America. For example, here's a little card that was handed out. I'll read to you what it says so you know, but it is a small version of a poster that was printed to publicize an event that I was doing in Canada at Mount Royal University there in Calgary, Canada. Now, this event was a sanctioned event by the university. That is, they got the permission. They were able to secure a room about this size, more chairs in it, so that I could respond to a challenge that was had arisen on campus. And the challenge was that it was intolerant to believe that Jesus was the only way of salvation. This is intolerant. And so I was scheduled to give a lecture answering the charge, and the title to the lecture was, "Is it intolerant to say that Jesus is the only way of salvation?" And here is the cards that were handed out there, and this was the same as the posters that they would put up to advertise the event, except, let me read to you what it says here. It's quite innocuous. "Is it intolerant to say Jesus is the only way?" By the way, that's me about 5 years ago. Here's what the text says. "Is choosing a religion merely a matter of preference, like chocolate or vanilla, or is it something more serious? Come here, speaker, author, radio talk show host Greg Coakland has the details." That's all it said. But we were not allowed to post the posters around the campus to advertise the university-sanctioned event. Why not? Well, there were two reasons they gave us. First, they said the title was divisive. Now, it strikes me, if answering the charge that it's intolerant to believe Jesus is the only way is divisive, then maybe making the charge is also divisive. But this had not occurred to them. So you can make the charge, but you can't answer the charge, okay? Here's the second thing that they said was wrong with the poster. They said the poster had racial overtones.
Chocolate.
Now, some of you are thinking, wait a minute, I just heard him read that. What possibly could be the problem? Blessed are the pure in heart. Now, some of you more jaundiced folk here have already got the problem. It says chocolate and vanilla. Now, I understand that there are stores in Calgary, Canada that sell chocolate and vanilla ice cream, and I don't think there are lines of people protesting against the racial undertones of the flavors that are in their ice cream case. But in any event, this was the nature of the objection. And incidentally, the group that was responsible for this silencing of our free speech liberties was the Campus Human Rights Group. Now, before I read the next thing here, I need to give you a warning, because what I'm about to read is from a poster that was posted on a window of a bar in Olympia, Washington. So it's an advertisement for the establishment, Jake's Bar, but it has a naughty word in it. So I'm going to spell the word, I won't say it, in case you have tender ears, but we're all adults here. There's a purpose. I want you to understand something, so just be forewarned. But I was in Olympia, Washington, speaking also at a local junior college there and at a church, and my wife and I were walking in the community there. This is in the Seattle area, and this is a particularly liberal kind of town politically. And there was a bar there, Jake's Bar, that had this poster that was exhibited on the window. It's about this big. In fact, if you look closely at it, you can see my reflection vaguely there as I was taking the picture of the poster for the record. And let me just read it to you, because they are advertising what they offer here in Jake's Bar. Jake's is a hate-free queer bar. We welcome everybody, unless you are homophobic, transphobic, racist, sexist, heterophobic, thief, drug dealer, violent, bigot, or an A-S-S-H-O-L-E. Now, if none of these apply to you, welcome! Have a fabulous time. Then in smaller letters it says, the staff at Jake's cares about you, and if you feel that someone here is compromising our safe, hate-free space, please don't hesitate to let one of us know. Thanks, Jake's staff. And of course, you know the subtext there, you know, we'll take the A-S-S-H-O-L-E and we'll throw them out on the street, is the idea there. So what is the message here from Jake's Bar? We are a hate-free bar that welcomes everybody that is just like us. If you don't agree with all of our views and all of our things, out you go. And then once in a while, you're going to see something like this. This is a headline from the Los Angeles Times. And I often wonder, there's a headline there and two pictures. The headline says, gay leaders say protesters are using hateful tactics. And then you have two photos there. And I often wonder what the layout people are thinking sometimes when they put this together. They don't see what strikes to me as kind of an obvious irony. And if I had my PowerPoint, this would be larger. But gay leaders say protesters are using hateful tactics. And there you have two photographs. And indeed, there you see some people with posters like this. And you see these angry faces. And their mouth is open. And there's this scowl. And there's the angry protester. Oh, wait a minute. Those aren't the protesters. Those are the gay leaders. That's the gay leaders. Who are the protesters? There they are, five Russian old women in babushkas sitting on a park bench. These are the dangerous, hateful people. And these illustrations serve, I think, to make a point of the kind of confusion that's manifest. That is that the so-called tolerant crowd often seem to be the ones who are acting in the harsh, bigoted, judgmental, condescending, and oppressive ways. These champions of tolerance. Now, why does this unlikely confusion exist? That the tolerance ones seem to be exhibiting so much intolerance. And I think that in an odd and completely unpredictable way, the confusion on tolerance in the States that was kind of in play already before this happened, the events of 9/11, September 11, 2001, the attack on American soil by Muslim terrorists that took 2,977 lives, I think that this set the stage, and this was very curious because within just a few weeks after the attacks, Thomas Friedman, who is one of the intelligentsia in the States, he was writing for the New York Times, wrote an article called The Real War. And in this article, while the smoke is still rising from the Twin Towers, he says, we are in a new war now, and it's not a war against terrorism. Terrorism is just a means to an end. The real war is a war regarding what he termed religious totalitarianism. Now, what is religious totalitarianism? This is the view that people hold that their own religion is true and other religions are false. That's called religious totalitarianism. Now, of course, the people who flew those planes into the Twin Towers and into the Pentagon and into that field in Pennsylvania, did they believe that their religion was true? Of course, they gave their life for their religion. But so does virtually everybody in this building right now, certainly in this room. Followers of Christ also believe their religion is true. And so what Thomas Friedman did is he lumped all religious fundamentalists together in one group, irrespective of their convictions. Never mind that the Christian fundamentalists would likely pray for you and the Muslim fundamentalists might kill you. That distinction wasn't made in the article. It was anybody who has an exclusive view of religion is dangerous. And this then gave rise, I think, or was part of the thrust that launched the new atheists who came in right on the heels of this event. Because the new atheists are not new in their ideas. Their ideas are the same. Their arguments are the same. They have a little bit more attitude than the 20th century atheists who are a little bit more pleasant and doctrinaire and academic. But these guys have an attitude. But there's another element. The new atheists think that theists are not just wrong. They think they're dangerous. And of course, the model theist is the Christian, and so Christians are dangerous. And this idea that Christians are dangerous, I see popping up all over the place. I see it in TV shows where these issues are discussed. In American TV personalities like Rosie O'Donnell on her shows says that radical Christianity is just as threatening as radical Islam in a country like America. Now, that's a quote, by the way. I'm not paraphrasing. Bill Maher on Bill O'Reilly's show. Bill Maher, a comedian, but a major spokesperson for leftist causes and anti-religion, says that the ones that make the headlines, the evangelical Christians, are usually the ones who are behind everything that represents intolerance and bigotry. And that, by the way, is also an exact quote. And I actually heard Chris Matthews, who does a political show called Hardball, and also very well known in the States in that regard, say the group most like the Taliban in the United States is the religious right. Now, this is completely undeserved. And yet we have obnoxious people on the right who are religious people, but this is not characteristic of the right. It's actually more characteristic of the left, but we're not going to get political. The point is, why we are being viewed, Christians in particular, are being viewed in this dangerous role in the States, and I think to some degree here as well. And I think that what's at the root of the confusion are two related concepts that people have been taken in by. I'm just going to call them right now the myth of neutrality and the myth of tolerance. And with this as an introduction, what I want to do in our remaining time is basically three things. Given that the notion of tolerance, which is part of the problem here, is built on a commitment to neutrality, I want to argue that neutrality is a myth, that nobody's neutral. And if neutrality is a myth, then any notion of tolerance, and I'm going to give you a heads up or advance notice, that the tolerance I'm talking about now is actually a distortion of the historical virtue of tolerance. I'm talking here about postmodern tolerance. That postmodern tolerance, if that is built on the notion of neutrality, that if neutrality is a myth, then this tolerance is going to be a myth also. I'm also going to argue that there is nothing unusual about thinking one religious view is true and another is false. Reason itself requires this view. It isn't because I'm a Christian. It's because I'm thinking carefully about the issue. It's not bigotry. It's just simple math. And I'm going to show that. And then finally, I want you to show you very specifically how the current politically correct version of tolerance is actually intolerance in disguise. It is the intolerance of tolerance. So let's take each in order. The myth of neutrality. I want to read something to you that was written by Faye Waddleton. You may not be familiar with this name, but you are familiar with Planned Parenthood. And for years, she was the president of Planned Parenthood in the States. And at the time, a while back in the 90s, she wrote a piece about morality that I want to read to you. Now, I'm not reading to ridicule her. I don't think that's a good idea, frankly. I am going to critique, but not ridicule. In fact, I think this is really well written. It's a great example of a view that I want to critique, and it is so well written that when I read it to you, you're going to be thinking, with regards to tolerance, gee, that makes a lot of sense. I'm probably not supposed to agree with her, but I don't know how I can disagree without sounding weird, okay? But there's a flaw in it, and that's what I want to get to here. And so let me just read this piece to you on morality by Faye Waddleton and see if you catch the mistake. Quote, like most parents, I think that a sense of moral responsibility is one of the greatest gifts I can give my child, but teaching morality doesn't mean imposing my moral values on others. It means sharing wisdom and giving reasons for believing as I do and then trusting others to think and judge for themselves. My parents' morals were deeply rooted in religious conviction, but tempered by tolerance. There's our word. The essence of which is respect for other people's views. They taught me that reasonable people may differ on moral issues and that fundamental respect for others is morality of the highest order. I have devoted my career, she writes, to ensuring a world in which my daughter Felicia can inherit that legacy. I hope the tolerance and the respect I show for her as a parent is reinforced by the work she sees me doing every day, fighting for the right of all individuals to make their own moral decisions about childbearing. 75 years ago, Margaret Sanger founded Planned Parenthood to liberate individuals from the mighty engines of repression. As she wrote, the men and women of America are demanding that they be allowed to mold their lives not at the arbitrary command of church or state, but as their conscience and judgment may dictate. She closes, I'm proud to continue that struggle to defend the rights of all people to their own beliefs. When others try to inflict their views on me, my daughter, or anyone else, that's not morality, it's tyranny. It's unfair, and it's un-American. Close quote. Wow, that's good writing. It sounds so sensible, it sounds so reasonable, so persuasive, so tolerant. But there's a fundamental flaw here. Now, first I want you to know, what is her basic view of morality? Do you notice the implicit emphasis on neutrality? That we should trust others to think and judge for themselves, that we should be allowed to mold our lives as our conscience and judgment may dictate. So what Waddleton is advancing here is a kind of a moral neutrality, a non-interference. We should be neutral and tolerant towards other people, and if we're not neutral, we're not tolerant, okay? And these awful pro-lifers are interfering. Okay, fair enough. What's the flaw? I can give it to you in one sentence. It's a rhetorical question. I'll answer it for myself, but you're thinking about it, aren't you? Simply put, Faye Waddleton is not neutral. Five words. She's advancing neutrality, but she's not neutral at all. She wants to continue this struggle to defend the rights of all people to their own beliefs, but then has this to say of those whose beliefs are different from hers on this issue. They're unfair, they're un-American, and they're tyrannous. Do you notice those are moral labels? Those are judgments, moral judgments. Do you think that she shows the same neutral respect for somebody who's pro-life who wants to put their body against the door of an abortion clinic and block that? No, she thinks that's wrong. She's not trying to fight to defend those people's right to their own beliefs. No. In fact, she wants to stop them from doing that. And she has no trouble forcing her views on other people. How do I know that? Because she said it in her piece. Really, where was that? Remember she said, I have devoted my career to ensuring a world in which my daughter Felicia can inherit that legacy. What legacy is she talking about? About her moral point of view. And how does she try to ensure that? She's a lobbyist in Washington, D.C., trying to compel senators and congressmen to pass laws to force everybody else to live according to her view. And just to put a sharper point on it, not long after this, they passed a law that made it illegal to block an abortion clinic, federal offense. And the woman who followed Faye Waddleton as president of Planned Parenthood, Pamela Moraldo, said this. I heard it with my own ears. This law goes to show that no one can force their morality on anybody else. Well, it's laughable because all laws force the morality. That's the point of law. Now, look, I don't want you to miss this. I'm not complaining that Faye Waddleton's trying to pass laws. This is the way we do things in a representative republic. You know, more power to her. I'm just saying it's not what? It's not neutral. Faye Waddleton talks neutrality, but she seeks to enforce her point of view. This appeal to neutrality is very attractive, even persuasive, but it is a myth. So you just listen. Now you know. I've given you the heads up. When you're in conversations with people who are advancing the tolerance issue based on implicitly a commitment to neutrality, just listen up. They open their mouth with regards to any view. They're weighing in on one side or another. They open their mouth, they've lost their neutrality. They have a point of view. And I can give you many examples of this. We're just touched for time on this. And I want to have some Q&A here at the end. But I'll give you one other, though. There was in the States, the Southern Baptists every year have a domestic missions emphasis. That is that as a denomination, they're going to pursue some summer mission effort, and they ask the church at large to be praying for that and donating to it and everything. And so in their internal communications, they mentioned in the spring that they were going to be spending time in the city of Chicago and especially trying to reach out to Jews with the gospel. Oh, well, when the press got a hold of this, they had a heyday because this was just unthinkable that Christians would go and seek out Jews to try to convert Jews. I mean, this was just over the top. And on Larry King, when he still had his show, they actually had two members of the Southern Baptist Convention and two rabbis, one from New York and one from Chicago, that were on the other side of the table. And I'm just going to say that these gentlemen were very angry, the rabbis, not the Baptists, because they thought this absolutely unthinkable that someone would go and try to convert someone who already had a religion. And once again, you had this interesting situation where you had two people that were just over the top angry and expressing that, and two people that were calm and collected and gracious. It was the Christians that were the gracious one. It was the rabbis in this particular case that were over the top yelling and hurling invectives. And notice the complaint, though. They said, we already have a religion. If you want to go evangelize somebody, find someone who doesn't already have a religion and then communicate that. Now, the posturing there was, you ought to be neutral towards us because we have the kind of thing that you're peddling. Find someone who needs that kind of thing. But notice what was going on, though, really. When the rabbi said, we already have a religion, go find somebody who doesn't have a religion, don't try to change ours. What were they communicating? They were communicating a religious point of view about evangelism, weren't they? They have a point of view about evangelism that was different than the Christians' point of view about evangelism. And they were demanding in no uncertain terms that the Christians adopt their view of evangelism instead of the Christians' view of evangelism. So what were the Jewish rabbis doing? They were doing the same thing they were accusing the Christians of doing. They were trying to change the Christians' religious point of view about evangelism. Of course, nobody saw that. I saw it, and probably some other thoughtful people who kind of understand how this kind of things work. But the rank and file thought that the rabbis were within their rights to be angry, and they were the tolerant crowd, and it was these intolerant Christians that were the troublemakers, when in fact the rabbis were doing the very same things they were complaining about. Now, neutrality is a myth, which ought to raise some questions about the legitimacy of the tolerant views that all religions are equally right. And about 9 years ago, I was on a TV show in Canada. It was a secular program called Test of Faith. And on this program, they invite some religious weirdo out, and they sit him at the table. And then on the opposite side of the table, they bring in other people to kind of beat up the religious weirdo, you know, on national TV for an hour. Kind of fun. Where do you think Mr. Coca was sitting, by the way? I was the religious weirdo in the hot seat. Now, what was my weird religious... What qualified me to be the weirdo? Here it was. The program was on religious pluralism. Now, religious pluralism isn't just the idea that there are lots of options with religion in any culture. I mean, this is pretty obvious, and it's uncontroversial. Religious pluralism is the notion that there are lots of options, and they're all equally legitimate ways to God. So, I mean, popular ways of stating religious pluralism is all roads lead to Rome. Religiously, all the paths lead to the top of the mountain. You know, you've heard this before. In contrast to the narrow-minded, arrogant, bigoted Christians who think that their way is right. Okay, so that's what this show was about. I was a weirdo because I was the Christian. So they put me in the hot seat, and there was a Sikh, there was a Hindu pastor, and there was a female pastor of the United Church of Canada, pluralists all. She was a liberal Christian pastor. And Valerie Pringle was the host who had me come on. Now, when I arrived there, I got in a conversation with somebody on the crew before the program started. And in these programs, they always have somebody that calls you in advance. They phone you where you live. And they say, we're thinking about having you on the show. And they ask you questions. You have an interview. They want to make sure you're weird enough for their show. And so the fella who had given the interview was actually there. And he's an atheist. And we were getting along fine. We made friends over the phone kind of thing. Hey, hi, nice to meet you finally, blah, blah, blah. I said, let me make a bet with you about how this show's going to go. Just a gentleman's wager. I'm going to give an argument against pluralism. And people are not going to, they're not going to, those on the panel are not going to pay any attention to my argument. Instead of that, they're going to attack me personally, and they're going to start calling me names like narrow-minded and arrogant and bigoted and that kind of thing. But they're not going to address the issue. They're going to change the subject. I don't know. Maybe it won't go like that, but it usually does. We'll see. So that's my wager. So I get up at the program, and the first segment, 5 minutes or so, I get a chance to make my case. I'm by myself with the host, and so I'm going to make my case against pluralism. Now, I had made a strategic decision regarding how I wanted to prosecute this when I was on the show. What I could have done is I could have said, I'm a Christian. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. Jesus is right. If he's right, then he's the only way, and if he's the only way, then other religions are wrong, and QED. That's a legitimate way to argue, I think. But what it does is it puts Jesus and Christianity dead center as the target. We were supposed to be talking about pluralism, though, not necessarily about how bad Jesus was. So I wanted to make that the center. I wanted to stay on topic. So I was planning to give an argument against pluralism that did not trade on my religious conviction. That is, it's an argument anybody could use, regardless of whether they're a Christian or not, and even if they were an atheist who is willing to say, I'm open to possibility, maybe some religion is right, but I tell you one thing, they aren't all right. Okay, so here's the argument, and I gave this to Valerie Pringle, the first segment. I said, Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. All right. He either was or he wasn't. Now, if he wasn't the Messiah, and some might say, well, Jesus never existed. Well, then he wasn't the Messiah. So that's the option. You only have two. If Jesus wasn't the Messiah, then the Jews are right on that issue and the Christians are wrong. If he was the Messiah, then the Christians are right and the Jews are wrong, but under no circumstance can they both be right. Do you see that? Okay, it's pretty straightforward. If God exists, it's an open question. He's either personal or not. He's impersonal, a power, a force, or something like that. Now, if he's impersonal, then the Hindus are right, the Christians and the Muslims and Jews are just wrong on this. If it turns out that God is personal, then the Christians, Jews, and Muslims are right on that particular point, and the Hindus are wrong, but under no circumstance can they both be right. When you die, I don't know, maybe you go to heaven or hell, maybe you get reincarnated, maybe you lay in the grave, but you can't do them all at the same time. Somebody's making a mistake. It's not bigotry, it's just simple math. Okay? And in fact, if that argument seems to go through, and I think it's a good argument, it's not just that somebody's wrong, but most people are wrong. Think of it. Regardless of which religion is true, most people aren't that religion. Which means that most people are making a mistake. And this is the dictates of reason here. Maybe they're all wrong, but they can't all be right. So there's my case. I said there are two ways around that, two attempted ways around that, but both of those ways have problems, and I didn't think anybody in the panel was even going to try that. Commercial break. First person up is the Sikh. Valerie Pringle says, Mr. Singh, Tishar Singh from Toronto, a barrister there. Real nice to be in the green room. But he came out swinging when the cameras were rolling. Actually, it was kind of a passive-aggressive start because when she asked him, what do you think about what Mr. Kokel said? He said, well, if Mr. Kokel thinks he won the lottery, good for him. The what? The what? Well, of course, I knew what he was getting at. And if you think about it a moment, you'd know this too. He had gone on the internet and he checked out my name. He'd gone to our website, str.org. And he knew that I was an evangelical Christian who was an exclusivist, not a pluralist. And I think I'm right. And I won the prize. Lucky me. And that's what he was doing. So he's starting out in kind of a snide, passive-aggressive way, but he didn't stay passive for long, and pretty soon he's almost out of his seat, waving papers at me that he's downloaded from the internet and going after me, and Valerie Pringle's got to push this guy down in the seat. Now, the Hindu pastor, when he came up, he was a little bit nicer, going after me, and the female pastor from the United Church of Canada, also very aggressive. And what was interesting about the conversation is that nobody was addressing my argument. Instead, after a little while, certain words started creeping into the conversation. Words like arrogant, narrow-minded, intolerant. Now, were they answering my reasonable case here against? No, they were fulfilling my prophecy. In fact, I even pointed that out. I said, you know, it's interesting how we started talking about an idea, pluralism, but now we've seemed to have gotten off the track. Now we're not talking about the issue anymore. Now we're talking about me. We're talking about Mr. Kokel's personality. Mr. Kokel is arrogant. Mr. Kokel's intolerant. Mr. Kokel's mean, I guess, is what you mean to be saying. I'm just a nasty guy. How about we do this? I said, why don't I just agree with you that I'm mean? I'm all those things that you say that I am. Why don't I just agree with that? So now we can set that aside and get back to what we're supposed to be talking about. And I also pointed out, your line of challenge here, you seem to be implying that I'm wrong in my view. Well, if I'm wrong in my view as a Christian, well, then Christianity's not true. But if Christianity's not true, then it's not a legitimate way to God. And if it's not a legitimate way to God, then it's not true that all religions lead to God. In other words, if you're right about what you're attacking me on, then you're wrong about what we're supposed to be talking about here today. They didn't get it. One whole hour, they didn't get it. The atheist got it. And after the show was over, he bounded up on the stage and he was, he was really mad at the Sikh. And he was using language appropriate for an atheist at the time. Now, I want to show you how to deal with this challenge. I call this, by the way, the passive-aggressive tolerance trick. And the idea is the trick being when somebody else is claiming that you're intolerant because you oppose their way of thinking. You think some other view is mistaken, you think your view is correct, and this qualifies you for the charge that you're intolerant. And there's something I always encourage Christians to do when they are called a name like that. You ask this question. This is a tactical maneuver. I wrote a book called Tactics. This is part of the way we approach these things, maneuvering with questions in particular. One way we maneuver with questions is to use questions to gather information. Another one is to make a point. All right? So in this case, I want to make a point, but I have to gather a little information first, and I'm going to use questions to do both. So you always ask the question when somebody calls you a name, bigoted, arrogant, whatever it happened to, intolerant, what do you mean by that? That's the question. What do you mean by that? And you want them to give you some kind of characterization of what it is that you're doing wrong that justifies their personal attack on you. What do you mean by that? Now, I know what they mean by that when they say I'm intolerant and those people on the TV show. They were mad because I thought I was right. I wasn't willing to say everybody's right. I'm just right for me. But everybody else is right for them, and everybody's right. No, I thought I was right, and other people are wrong. Okay? So that's usually, I'm going to get some version of that when the person says, well, here, you think you're right. I say, why? What do you mean by me being intolerant? Well, you think you're right. You think you're right, and other people are wrong. The female pastor of the United Church of Canada said, some people think they have the corner on the truth. Like that, you know who some people were. It was the other person on the panel in the hot seat, that's what. Well, of course, I never made such a claim. I never said I had the corner on the truth. Like I got it all right and everybody else has got everything wrong. But on this particular issue, I think I'm correct and this is why I was being faulted. Okay, so now I have the definition. You think you're right. Now let me ask you a question. If I'm in a discussion with somebody else about some kind of significant moral or theological issue, and I weigh in, I give my point of view, do you think that I think I'm right? It's not a trick question. Do you think that I think I'm right? Of course I think I'm right. If I didn't think I was right, I wouldn't believe what I believed. I'd believe something else and believe that was right, for goodness sake. But I'm not the only person in this conversation who thinks he's right, am I? And this is the key. Because the other person thinks they're right too. And so when somebody says, well, you think you're right, I'll say, yeah, well, I do think I'm right. Maybe I'm mistaken. We can talk about it. But let me ask you a question. Do you think you're right? You hold an opposite view than I. Do you think you're correct? What's he going to say? I think I'm dead wrong. Actually, that's what made the atheist angry in that conversation, because I asked the Sikh if he thought he was right, and he said no. Now, what he meant is he did not think Sikhism had to be the religion of everybody else. But I don't know why he would say that if he thought Sikhism was true, and if he didn't think it was true, why is he a Sikh? For goodness sake. So in any event, I mean, this is ridiculous for somebody to say, yes, I have all these beliefs and I think they're false. No, of course he thinks he's right. Now, it might be that they will use the kind of postmodern two-step and they'll say, well, I think my views are right for me. Well, if your views are just right for you, then why are you talking to me right now? Sounds to me like you're implying that I'm wrong. Aren't you the tolerant one and I'm the intolerant one and I should be like you, tolerant? Of course you think you're right. Okay, now, final question. Notice how this has gone. He says, you're intolerant. I say, what do you mean by that? He said, well, you think you're right. I said, well, I do, but what about you? Do you think you're right? Final question. Why is it that when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant, but when you think you're right, you're just right? What am I missing here? That's what I ask him. Of course, I'm not missing anything. He's missing it. What he has done is just simple name calling. That's it. He calls me intolerant. What if I said, and you're ugly? No, I wouldn't say that. That wouldn't be very polite. And it wouldn't be relevant, which is the point. He attacks my character. I attack his looks. Neither of us at that point are talking about whatever issue it is that launched the conversation. That's a distraction. Many of you already know the move. It's an informal fallacy called ad hominem, attacking the person instead of the argument. This is bad manners and bad thinking. And I want the person to see, and that's why I ask these questions. I want them to see, look, you've changed the subject. We were talking about same-sex marriage. Now you're calling me a bigot. So now we're talking about my personality. Do you want me to talk about your looks? You can talk about my character. I'll talk about your looks. We can fight about that. But I'd rather talk about same-sex marriage. So if you have something productive to say about same-sex marriage, instead of changing the subject and attacking me, well, I'd be interested to hear it. And this is why sometimes at this point, when somebody says, well, you're a bigot, instead of asking the question, you know, what do you mean by that? I might say, why did you change the subject? And they'll say, what do you mean? Well, we were talking about that, now we're talking about this. Why did you do that? Notice that that's a question, and it's not rhetorical. I'm tossing the ball into his court. I want him to respond back because I want them to see that they have just done something unkind and irrational in this discussion. But this is the number one way people deal with issues in our culture today that they don't like. They just call names, and they think they're smart. And they may be smart, but they think this is a smart response, and it's not. It's stupid. And I want to try to find some generous way to help them to see that. And that's what this little maneuver is meant to help you to do, to uncover the passive-aggressive tolerance trick. Now, let me tell you why this kind of thing happens. When I was in Des Moines, Iowa, I was doing some teaching in the city, and then down the road in Ames, Iowa, is the University of Iowa, and a few days later I was going to be speaking there on campus, and I had like Monday off, and somebody in town found out I was around, and they said, can you come and speak to our high school seniors at our Christian school? And I had the free time. I'm there to work, so, and it isn't like Des Moines, Iowa, in January is the tourist capital of the world. Not much to do there. Can watch him milk the cows or something. And so I said, I'd be glad to. Of course, at that point, I lied because I wasn't glad to talk to high schoolers. I was willing to talk to high schoolers, but no, I'm not really fond of talking to high schoolers. To me, that's like talking to a painting. You know, I like talking to responsive human beings. And I can address a high school group and I could say something so funny that the adults are falling off the chair and the high schoolers are are you going to laugh? No. We're not going to laugh. Yes. All right. Okay. So anyway, but I was going to give it my best shot. Now this, remember, this is a Christian high school. It was the religion class. It was, were seniors. They filed in. There really wasn't that many of them. There was a big table in front. They filed in behind the table and they sat down looking at me. So it was kind of like the Last Supper. This is what I'm looking at, Da Vinci's Last. And I wanted to talk to them about this tolerance problem. And so I thought I'd introduce it by getting some group participation a little bit about what tolerance was. And it took me a while to draw them out and get them to kind of contribute a little bit. But I was able to get kind of a working definition of tolerance that I wrote on the board. And so we're talking about the issue of tolerance. And the working definition were all views are equally valid. Okay? I wrote that down on the board. No controversy here. Yeah, okay, we get that. No problem. Then I turned to the board and I wrote another sentence. And this is what I wrote. Jesus is the Messiah, and Jews who reject him are wrong. Now, them's fighting words, aren't they? And in fact, at this point, the painting came alive. And there was a young lady off to the side, and she's waving her hand, and she said, "You can't say that. You can't say that. That's," and what do you think she said? This Christian student, as a senior in a Christian high school religion class, she said, "That's
intolerant."
And then she said, "How would you like it if somebody said you were wrong?" Think about it. I said, "You mean like you're doing to me right now, young lady?" Doesn't bother me at all. Do you see how blithely these students say things like this, and how fully taken in they are by this nonsense? She can't even see the contradiction. And worse than this postmodern definition of tolerance is teaching our children that they have a right to be angry if somebody takes exception with them. How would you like it if somebody said you were wrong? Doesn't bother me a bit. I'm a grown-up. So I turned around to the board, and I circled the definition of tolerance that we were working with. All views are equally valid. And I asked this question of the students. I said, is this a view? Is that all views are equally valid, is that a view? Yeah. Okay, good. Progress. Then I circled the next sentence. Jesus is Messiah. Jews who reject him are wrong. And I asked the same question. Is that a view?
This is painful.
Yes, that's a view. Gee, this is kind of interesting, I said. Tolerance teaches that all views are equally valid, and that Jesus is Messiah and Jews who reject him is wrong, is a view. What must we say about this sentence? That it is what? It is just as valid as any other view. But gee, that creates a problem, doesn't it? Because tolerance says all views are equally valid, which would mean that would include even the views that say all views are not equally valid. In other words, all views are equally valid and not equally valid at the same time. You see a problem here? Even those high school seniors could see that problem. This is a contradiction. What I want you to see here, friends, is something that almost nobody sees, is that the current understanding of tolerance turns out to be contradictory virtually every single time it's put into play. This is why the tolerance street is a one-way street. Just like Jake's Bar, we tolerate everybody who's just like us. This is contradictory. This kind of tolerance cannot work. And every time somebody tries to enforce this kinds of tolerance, they end up being hoist upon their own petard. It's a suicide situation. So I asked the students, "You want to know how to get out of this?" They said, "Yes." I said, "Okay. This is the postmodern understanding of tolerance. I want to give you the classical understanding of tolerance, and this particular way of putting it, I got from Peter Kreft from Boston College. You might have read some of Dr. Kreft's work. He does a lot of work with C.S. Lewis. In any event, there are 2 points to classical tolerance. Here's the first one. Be egalitarian regarding people. Now, these kids didn't know what egalitarian meant. I said, just think, treat equally. Treat human beings with equal dignity and respect. And this, by the way, is what makes classical tolerance a virtue. Because the first thing out of the gate is we are committed to treating other human beings with equal dignity and respect. And this makes sense in the Christian worldview because we can ground this in the image of God and man. Why treat them with respect? If they're just evolved animals, what's the reason for that? There is no good reason. On the Christian worldview, we can explain this feature of reality, and that is that human beings are special, and we should treat them special. They're made in the image of God, therefore we treat them with equal respect. Here's the second point. Be elitist regarding ideas. Now, these students knew what an elitist was. Well, an elitist is a snob. I said, yeah, what's a snob? Well, a snob is somebody who thinks they're better than somebody else. That's right. So you should be snobby about ideals in the sense that you should believe that some ideas are better than other ideas. Now, why would anybody think that? That some ideas are better than others? Because they are. Some ideas are good, some are bad, some are true, some are false, some are dumb, some are dangerous. And we should have the freedom, shouldn't we, in the process of public discourse to try to figure out which one's which without calling people names because they disagree. And so in the classical sense of tolerance, it gives us freedom to pursue the truth, yet constrains us morally in the way we treat people, in the way we pursue the truth. You see that? Now I want you to see one more thing that I showed the students. This is the classic view of tolerance. This is the kind of tolerance that's a virtue. The kind of tolerance practiced right now is not elitist regarding ideas, or at least this is what it claims, but rather it demands egalitarianism with regards to ideas. All ideas are equally valid. Multiculturalism. There is no truth. Truth is socially constructed, however you want. There are no meta-narratives, right? But once you are egalitarian regarding ideas, what happens if somebody doesn't go along with that? Well, then you can turn on them. And you can attack them. And you can treat them in undignified ways and feel right about it, just like all those examples that I'm talking about. In other words, the new tolerance is be egalitarian regarding ideas and be elitist towards people so that the politically correct get the respect. And those that are not politically correct are personas non grata, and you can mistreat them any way you want. In other words, the postmodern definition of tolerance is exactly the opposite in practice as the classical virtuous sense of tolerance. Tolerance has become intolerance, and intolerance has become tolerance. So here's my closing appeal, and I give the same talk to secular audiences. My closing appeal is simply this. Regardless of what your personal convictions are, do not be taken in by this trick. Don't give in to the tendency to dismiss a view with politically correct name-calling like you're intolerant. And if you're, as a follower of Christ, don't allow people to do that. Be willing to stand up and point this trick out. Rather, address the issues. Consider the facts, weigh the evidence, because in the final analysis, when all the facts are in on some particular issue, it may turn out, once the smoke is cleared and the truth is fully evident, that the person who is simply dismissed as intolerant may be the one who turns out to be right in the end. And then it'll be too late. Now here I have in mind, when I say this, eternal issues. Oh, you Christians, you're intolerant. It may turn out if you dismiss the gospel for that foolish reason, it may turn out that it was true in the end, and now it's too late for you. Don't make that mistake. Okay, well, I think we have some time for questions, or are we done here? How is this
working? No, we have some time for questions.
Okay, good.
Questions. Thank you very much for a very interesting question.
It is the case. I'll answer the second first and then the first second. Certainly there are circumstances that you're going to get in where people, especially if there's a belligerent interaction to begin with, and it's hard to rescue a person from that belligerence. Okay, it's not impossible, but it's difficult, partly for the reason that you mentioned. But it isn't always like that, and oftentimes that we get to speak as Christians, and it's not head to head, one on one, but it's more a little bit to a group of people, and there's not the personal thing at stake there. They're not defending turf, but they're listening, and this gives them an opportunity to assess their whole approach. Well, wait a minute, he's got a point, you know, maybe he's got a point there. Now, there's no silver bullet in any of this. It isn't like this is the magic thing and the person who's attacking you is going to say, oh my, well, they probably won't say, oh my God, but they might say, oh my gosh, I don't know, but I'm mistaken, oh, thank you for correcting me. I mean, this human nature isn't like that, but that does not mean that points given that are sound points aren't considered. I think they are, even sometimes afterwards, whatever. So I think this is a fruitful pursuit, even if it's not a silver bullet, okay? If you're in a, like with your wife, you know, you always think you're right, and yeah, probably in that circumstance it's not gonna help much, but that's because there are other things that are going on there. But that isn't always the way the communication turns out to be. So that's one thought. The second thought about the intolerance of Christians, it kind of, I'm not entirely sure what it is you're referring to, but I want to make just a general observation about this. I think when you look at the internet and you see Christians responding to non-Christians, it's ghastly, it's shameful. But keep in mind that this, and there's no excuse for this whatsoever, but that's a small slice of Christianity. I want people to consider this. Where do we get our information about most things? If you're thinking about larger groups of people, where do we get our information about that? We get our information largely from the media. I was interviewed by Newsweek magazine about 5 or 6 years ago, and the guy on Newsweek says, why do you Christians only care about homosexuality and abortion? I said, that's not all we care about. That's all you write about. We care about all, this is right after Katrina. Every church I was in had something going on to help in Katrina. But this wasn't being reported on because if it bleeds, it leads, and this wasn't bleeding in the way they wanted it to bleed. And so consequently, I think that sometimes our impression of what American Christians are like is not based on a broad exposure to lots of rank and file American Christians, or European Christians for that matter, right? This is across the board, but based on what is reported. And I think that gives a distorted cross-section. I meet lots and lots and lots of Christians. I'm in lots and lots and lots of churches. And of course, I'm not testing every person's character in that church, but I get a sense of what they're about and what they believe in. I can see the kind of programs that they have. It's in their bulletins, what they're doing. And these people are, you know, serving the Lord quietly and at great, at at great personal expense and self-sacrifice, and they're not going to get noticed by the media. The media doesn't care about that thing. So I am just wondering now if sometimes the impression of bellicose Christians in America is a bit distorted because of the cross-section that we're seeing that the press puts forward. Sometimes it's the wrong people that end up getting visibility, you know.
I agree with what you're saying.
All right, I'll let you...
It's a broader picture.
I'll let you have the last word on that. Okay, one more question, sir. I only have time for the question. There's no time for the answer. I'm sorry. Well, there's two questions very quickly. Why would somebody claim that all views who don't want to convince anybody is equally valid? It's one thing to say it, it's another thing to defend it. And a person who makes a claim like that bears a burden of proof. So this strikes me as arbitrary in terms of defining it that way. Second thing, does that atheist feel it's legitimate for him to try to convince me of that particular point? But the minute he tries to convince me, now if he's just kind of reporting, he might escape this. But if he's trying to campaign for it, now he's making the case that one view is correct and he's trying to change that view, and now he's doing the very thing that he says he shouldn't be doing. Okay, the only other thing I'd say about this, and again, none of this is a silver bullet, but these are, and you're right, there is an apathy. I think that's the key word here, because what you just described to me that the atheist would say does not make sense in a naturalistic worldview, because there is no grounds for mutual respect or for human rights and naturalism. Now, tomorrow night at the plenary session, I'm going to be talking about this just a little bit. Complacency is a huge problem, even in the States. So I'll give it back to you, and I thank you. The information, str.org.